Welcome to episode 8 of season 4 of the Filmmaker Film Watcher podcast. I'm filmmaker Richard DiGregorio.
And I am film watcher Greg Rowell.
Well, it's our ghostly episode, isn't it, Greg?
Well, you have no excuse because I've never claimed to be an actor. Yes, we're doing ghost films.
Yeah, that's right. From varying genres.
Yes, you're right, Ricardo. We've got one which is a classic ghost story. We have one which is more of a comedy, rom-com-y ghost story,
yeah,
horror thing.
That's right. And then we've also got like a really fantastical sort of surreal ghost story as well.
Which one's that?
Ghost story.
Oh, okay. That makes sense.
So, Greg, why don't you just launch into the first film we're going to talk about, which is Extraordinary.
You probably haven't heard of this gentle 2019 romantic comedy ghost story. It seems to have had little, if any, promotion. But it's a charmingly told tale, infused with whimsical humour and an Irish sensibility. Rose Dooley, such an Irish name, is a driving instructor who has put the brakes on her teenage past when she assisted her father Vincent, Richard Cooper, in his paranormal TV show. Vincent died some years ago during an exorcism, leaving Rose, Maeve Higgins, feeling guilty, telling her father, "Sorry for murdering you, Dad." Excerpts from Vincent's shows bring us into and punctuate this story, teaching us such useful things as nightmares may have been caused by eating cheese because you might have eaten a ghost, or warning against waking a floating goat, a gloating, because they'll explode. Vincent is still a local celebrity, and Rose must resolutely ignore her past and the continual requests to exorcise domestic ghosts, although she does keep Vincent's back catalogue videos in a locked shrine at home. Into Rose's lonely world steps the improbably named Martin, Barry Ward, who poses as a driving student to ask Rose to exorcise the ghost of his dead wife, Bonnie, at the insistence of his teenage daughter, Sarah, Emma Coleman. Bonnie continues to direct the minutiae of Martin's life from beyond the grave, leaving domestic reminders on his mirror and toast and physically intervening in what he can wear and eat. At first, Rose refuses Martin's request, but things get complicated when one-hit wonder and US tax exile Christian Winter, Will Fort, needs a virgin to complete his deal with the demon Astaroth, Jed Murray, to regain his music career. Sadly, Christian's standby virgin has exploded in a gloating gone wrong, and he needs another virgin before the blood moon in a couple of days. Christian's incredibly inefficient and uber-phallic divination rod leads him to teenage Sarah, so Martin reaches out to Rose once again to rescue Sarah from a Linda Blair-type trance. Rose has no choice but to return to her talents, working with the psychically gifted Martin, whom she really fancies, to harvest the ectoplasm of seven ghosts before Astaroth arrives. This film has been critiqued as an overextended comedy sketch, but I disagree. The story and characters are strong and well-rounded. The special effects are high quality, way better than the film's indie feel led me to expect. And the film takes seriously its purpose and heritage as a rom-com and comedy horror, and their affectionate nods to genre buddies such as The Exorcist and Ghostbusters. The film achieves what it sets out to do, and I was thoroughly entertained. This was my second viewing, and there were newfound details to delight me this time around, such as the MacGuffin-branded jam jar used in the first Ectoplasm collection, and Bonnie's perennial fag in mouth on the cuckoo clock that Martin built for her, with tragic consequences. For me, the only disappointment was the ugly Australian character of Christian's wife, Claudia O'Doherty. She seemed a caricature compared to the others and added little to the story. But Ricardo, what did you think?
It's quite a bizarre film, this is. I didn't know what to expect from it, but I really loved its sensibility. I loved its
sensibility,
its atmosphere.
Is absolutely the right word, yeah.
I didn't know what to expect when I first started watching it, but I really got into it. And, you know, when you mention the effects in it, it is an indie film.
Yeah.
But it is really high quality, and it they do really well with the effects.
If you take the special effects out of it, it wouldn't have been an expensive film to make.
No.
The most expensive thing would have been the castle.
Yeah, but there's little touches in there, like when Rose is driving and she's seeing like the toaster cord
and the twig
and the twig and everything
and the rubbish bin, which pays off later on.
Yeah, no, it's really well done, and I love its pacing. It actually tells its story really well. Will Fort has an absolute ball with this role.
And apparently he's based on someone.
Right.
Some pop singer who exiled for tax reasons to Ireland, but I don't know who that is.
Yeah, right. But I thought Barry Ward was fantastic when he started to become the wife and
Bonnie.
Bonnie. He was fantastic.
He was pretty good at the first exorcism.
Yes.
When he played that peevish old Irish man.
Yeah.
And that was well done. And he was good when Vincent, Rose's father, inhabits him to give a kind of a warm emotional message.
Yeah.
But you're right, his highlight. And I've never heard of this guy before.
No, me neither.
But he's a revelation. The way he just keeps slipping repeatedly backwards and forwards with only a sneeze to kind of break the pace between himself and the ghost of his dead wife, who's a very, very different character.
Very different. That's one of the things I was thinking, well, would he be with someone like that? But anyway, obviously they did. But I loved Maeve Higgins was just fantastic in it.
Well, she's very warm.
She is.
And that's his first response that triggers her to think, oh, he might be a possibility because she's lonely.
Yeah.
Is he says that she's a very warm person and that really captures who she is.
Yeah, she's warm and sweet, you know, and very cute. How she handles her powers is just gorgeous.
Yeah.
I think. Look, the Claudia O'Doherty character,
who is an Australian actress.
Yeah, she is, yeah. Look, I thought she did quite well in it. I actually quite laughed at her character. I loved it when she was ordering the Chinese and then was like all these different little parts. But I agree with you that I think if you took that character out of the film,
You wouldn't lose much.
But I think she offered that a little bit more. But
to me, everyone else felt like a real person.
Yeah.
She didn't.
Right. I feel that the character, that one of the main reasons the character is there is that when Will Ford, who you're there to sort of go, well, he's an idiot. But when he actually kills her, you think, oh, well, you're actually nuts. You're actually going to go through with this and therefore Sarah may die. For that reason, she's got a good purpose. Because after that I went, oh, shit, actually, the fact that they've killed her, the fact that he's done that, then I don't know where this story's going to go and that they may kill Sarah.
Yeah, but you could have had a stronger character to fulfill that purpose. Mm. Like she could have been a Lady Macbeth kind of character. Mm. I mean, she was to a point, she was kind of nagging him on.
Yeah.
But you could have had someone who really was pushing him to reclaim his career and therefore the celebrity and wealth that she enjoyed. And then he kills her anyway. That could have been stronger. I just didn't like her character.
To me, that's a character or a script choice of adding that character in the script for a reason there. I thought she did quite well with it, with the role she had.
Well, apparently the two characters who do the most driving in the film, which is Rose, the driving instructor, and Claudia, the wife who drives her celebrity husband everywhere, they both can't drive in real life.
Oh, really?
Yes, they're the only two who can't.
Oh, but the whole thing, the fun they had with this and the fun references as well. I mean, when Rose is standing outside the house with the exorcist thing with the...
Yes,
with
and light coming through the window.
Light coming through the window. Just fantastic references. But with the ectoplasm, when they have to get the other ghosts, you know, he has to... And then he's...
It's quite revolting.
Oh, my. And then he's got to smother it. They've got to smother it over her face.
Which you don't actually see.
You don't see it.
Yeah. But every time he vomits up the ectoplasm, you get to see that.
Yeah, and even towards the end, you know, when he's spewing up and then he goes to kiss Rose. And I'm like, ah!
Oh, no, I know. I thought exactly the same thing.
It's disgusting.
But that's what's one of the really great things about this film. It just shifts effortlessly between different tones.
It does.
So, you know, when the first virgin explodes...
That's quite horrific, actually.
You don't see it happen, but then you see this girl's body in two halves just lying casually on the floor.
It is.
And it looks real.
And it looks very real. It's actually
not that I've seen many exploding virgins, but...
But when they showed the goat...
The gloating goat. The floating
goat,
yeah.
When that exploded on the television... And he goes, so no, you don't want to wake up. You don't want to wake up. You don't want to wake up because this is what happens. And Barry Ward's face, what the? Just
because of his daughter,
yeah.
And when Astaroth finally appears.
Oh, very
that's
good.
That's so well done.
Very well done.
And I don't want to spoil it, but the way they use surrounding objects to manifest him.
Yes.
And the way the floor falls away.
Oh, look. Look, the effects were very, very good. And we're going to talk about effects in a few other ones here.
Probably.
But they did it really well here. And I didn't expect it to go that way or be that good in sort of in that realm. So kudos to the filmmakers. They did a great job there.
The other thing about the special effects is when the daughter, Sarah, is floating, and there are scenes when she's floating down the road attached to cars, and she's obviously on wires or something, but you don't see it.
No, you don't. They've done
it feels like a really high-end film.
They did a very, very good job with that.
And I liked the slow car chase, which we've seen that done here in Australia in Crackerjack a few years ago, but that they're all meandering along with the floating body outside the cars. And when the good guys in their car, so Rose and Martin and Rose's sister and her boyfriend, Barry from council, are driving down the road looking for Sarah, who's been kidnapped by, you know, the bad guys. And Barry said, "Is that her there?" And there's her floating down the road, as if there'd be anybody else floating down the country road. Like, it's got those little touches all the way through.
It does. Its comedic sensibilities are
very strong, but it doesn't let those take over the other parts of the story.
No, it doesn't.
I also like the novel solution to how you rescue a virgin from a demon.
Oh, yeah.
Where this character, won't say who it was, says afterwards, "Well, I can always say that my first time was a threesome."
That's right.
Which is funny when you know the story.
It's actually a very, that's a funny moment. Yeah, I can't say too much about it, but that's a really good moment.
I also think there's a promise at the end. Did you watch all the way to the end of the credits?
No.
Oh, there's a promise of a sequel.
Oh.
So at the very end, you see another little excerpt from Vincent's TV show where he says, "Well, that's all from us. See you next time."
Oh.
And I would love to see a sequel because at this point you've actually got Martin who realises he's
Martin,
got powers.
Martin.
And you've got Rose kind of deciding that she's going to do this. They set up their own company. So the next part of the story would be really interesting to see if they can maintain that tone.
Yeah. They're like the comedic equivalent of Ed Warren and Lorraine Warren from The Conjuring, those sort of series.
Oh, I know who they
files.
Are, yeah.
Yeah.
The other criticism I've heard made of this film is that you get the Vincent episode interspersals during sort of the first half of the film, and then they kind of stop.
Which is fine.
You reckon?
Yeah, I think they're fine.
I don't think I missed them, but I wouldn't mind seeing more of it because it gives that nice kind of light tone.
Well, it does.
That slightly daggy feel.
But as the story progresses, I mean, you're learning about the characters in the first, but that's what you're learning about her through the father and all the rest of it.
Yeah, true.
So, you know, when the story progresses and that just leaves, it's fine. There's no real need for him to come back in those moments because we're really following the journey of Rose Dooley and Martin saving the daughter. So, you know, I didn't have a problem with that at all.
So what will you score this film?
Look, I'm going to give it a 7 out of 10.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was really enjoyable. You know, it's interesting. We're going to talk about some films tonight, which I think this is something different I haven't seen for a while, like in a ghost sort of comedy realm.
Mm.
I haven't seen a film like this.
Me. There's a tradition of this kind of film. If you go back to Ghostbusters further back
but
to Bob Hope and Cat and the Canary and so on. Yeah, no, you're right.
I haven't seen a film like this in a long time. And I think I think the Irish sensibility and the setting was great.
It all just melds so beautifully.
It does, yeah. So I really liked it. I really liked it.
Well, I'm giving it a 7 as well. I kind of hovered towards an 8 because it just... It sets itself a task and it does it so beautifully. It's not a great film, so I'm kind of 7, 7.5-ish, but I'm going to say 7, but a really joyous 7 because I just think there's so much to get out of this.
There is. It's enjoyable.
So for our second spooky story, Ricardo, why don't you tell us about a ghost story, the appropriately named A Ghost Story.
Yeah, that's one I was really looking forward to here. Written and directed by David Lowery, who also directed the lovely remake of Pete's Dragon, 2017's A Ghost Story is a supernatural drama film starring Casey Affleck, named C, and Rooney Mara, named M, a husband and wife living in a small house in Dallas, Texas. He's a musician and is somewhat connected to the place. However, she wants to move, feeling a real disconnection to the house. She hears noises and generally feels uncomfortable there. Tragically, C is killed in a car accident at the front of their house. And here begins the haunting and beautiful exploration of grief, love, loss, and the sheer meaning of existence begins. C becomes a ghost. Visually, a classic white sheet with eyes cut out. who's stuck in time, not wanting to leave. He simply watches her, day after day, seeing the life he knew and the woman he loves move on and slip away. He then watches new people move in, and hears a man talk about the meaning of one's existence and the importance to leave some kind of mark on the world in this cycle of life that continues on and on. I mean, it's quite a monologue. Now, I don't want to give too much away here, but then it gets quite surreal, where it plays with time, the future and the past, leading on to the present day, which is the beginning of the film. Now, I really didn't know what to expect from this film. I thought it was a spooky horror when I first saw the poster. Then I heard it was a drama. What I found was an art house piece, a film which asks questions about life and its meaning. I know some people would probably get bored by this. And I mean, look, there's a 4-minute scene, one shot of Rooney Mara eating pie. And it's not the only long take in this film. But in these moments, we are the ghost, watching the loneliness of someone who has just suffered terrible loss. The long takes are real moments. And then there's this square 4:3 aspect ratio, which is suddenly becoming ever so popular again. It's an interesting choice, but again, the director does this for a reason, to portray the claustrophobic feeling of being stuck or feeling trapped, like in a box. The cinematography is really lovely also. Look, I was a real fan of the Pete's Dragon remake, and I know that it's a very different kind of film, but it was the atmosphere and the tenderness that shone through that film. Look, I really like David Lowery's work, and a ghost story, what to me was a really memorable piece of cinema. Greg, what did you think?
Man, I was so bored. I found it tedious. I'm exactly what you described a moment ago. And I have to say, I was really hoping you weren't going to like it. Because I've read some
really
reviews that say how wonderful it is and so on. And it makes me feel shallow. That have I missed something? Look, but it's a tedious film.
If I was...
And I'm sorry. I'm on a roll now. I'm sorry, but when you talked about, you know, how much she loved him and missed him, how do you know that? You saw almost nothing of their relationship, really. You can't even bother giving the characters names, M and C. That's so Kafka, been done a million times. It was no sense of who they really were. And when she goes...
Well, you got a sense of that.
No, not
I've
really.
I got a
no.
sense of their... Of
oh, they
their...
cuddled a bit and no, she no. talked about leaving things in walls.
No. Yes.
And that was it. I mean, the one big moment of action, his death, you don't even get to see it. You get this languid panning across the front of the house,
yes.
and then see his body in the car.
Well, you don't. You don't need to see a car crash.
No, but it's just that nothing happens.
It doesn't matter.
And it's okay if it doesn't happen after he dies, if you want to suggest languid. But nothing ever happens. Even when she goes to see his body and says to the medical person, "Oh, can I have a moment alone with him?" She just looks at him. Like there's no tenderness or anything, and then she kind of wanders off.
Mm.
And then she moves out, and we don't see her again. And the big reveal...
Well, it's not about that. Once she moves... I mean, she, to me, they play that quite nicely, I thought, because you really see her, you know, the time moving on, okay? And she's moving on, okay? And the movie actually starts picking up the pace, and it actually has less long takes as the movie goes forward.
It's glacial. There was one point when I thought I'd accidentally touched the controls and paused the film. Because nothing was moving. And I was trying to unpause the film and got completely lost because it turned out it wasn't paused in the first place. Nothing was moving.
Look, okay.
Now, look, I'll go with you on one thing,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay? It is beautiful to look at.
Yeah, it is.
I read about how Lowry wanted that box look to be, you know, claustrophobic.
Oh, right. Okay, well, I
didn't
that
feel
it.
That. I actually, yeah. I thought it felt more oldie-worldy.
Mm.
It felt to me, I've heard it described as old Polaroids. To me, it felt like... Yeah, old photos or even a storybook or something.
Well, the thing is, it was a bit of different. It was there was 4:3 ratio, but they had the rounded edges. You had the rounded edges, which made it very Super 8 looking rather than just
It felt like old media to me.
That's right, and
I quite like that.
Yeah,
they are beautifully composed scenes, but you know, sitting there watching her eat pie for minutes on end,
four minutes, yeah,
four. Okay,
it's exactly four.
It felt like longer. The kind of and
some... look, I tell you, if you're not in the mood for this, look, I'm going to say, if you're not in the mood for this film, then you won't be into it, right?
You don't even have to be in the mood.
No, you do. I think you do. I was. I didn't.
Well,
you're
obviously deeper than I am. That's okay.
Well, I started watching it, but
I will have to live with that for all eternity.
The thing is, there's a reason why, and the thing is, David Lowery is a very, very good filmmaker, and he does things for a reason. There, I think, and that's why I was thinking, why are these takes so long? What I'm really trying to establish why this choice was done. That's what I really think. I really think you are the ghost in that sequence. So you are watching her, and that's what he's doing.
But it happened before he died.
No, after.
No.
At the pie. She was reading the pie after.
Yeah, but that wasn't the only one. There were long shots of the outside of the house or whatever
but
else.
That 4-minute and, one. Yes,
and
there
I've got bad news for you. You didn't watch the extra scenes, did you?
No.
The extras?
What are you
talking
about?
Oh, I did. I thought maybe there was more in there. There are extras.
Oh, I didn't
see
extras. And
there are two extra scenes. There's another version of the car accident scene where you see the driver of the other car slumping down upset. That was obviously too much movement and action, so they cut that. And the other scene was him making a cup of coffee. So he puts the kettle on to boil, he stares into middle space, away from the window, into the room, and just stares until the kettle finally boils. That's action. And then he pours it into one of those kind of drippolator kind of things on a mug. And while he waits for the coffee to filter through, he goes and sits at his Apple laptop and types something, and then he comes back and gets his coffee. Now, to me, so much of the film felt like that. But if you enjoyed those scenes, you need to go and watch that, Ricardo, because you've obviously missed out. Now, to me, this felt like something between a bad student project.
No, much better than that. Excuse me, let me finish.
Or something which would be beautiful projected onto the wall of a gallery.
That's what I'm saying. But it's an art piece.
Yes, but not to be watched as a movie or story.
Why not? Why can't film be
tedious?
Art?
Films can be art.
Yes,
but one of the core things about films is story.
It's trying to say something about time and existence. And
oh, yeah, no, and that's the other problem with this film.
Okay.
There's almost no dialogue in the film, which means you don't get an insight into their relationship up front. The only real dialogue in the whole film, and it's only an hour and a half, feels like a month and a half, is the character called the protagonist, who basically explains to you what the whole film's supposed to be
about.
That's
right, yeah.
So if you have to have a character halfway through say to you, now that you've stuck with us for half an hour, I think it was an hour, let me tell you what it's all about, mm-hmm. and so you can make sense of the rest when nothing happens.
Yeah.
It's a bad script. No.
You didn't get into it. I really liked it. I went with it. And
where did you go with it? There was nowhere to go.
There was. It was doing something different, okay? And I love cinema that does that.
I can watch paint dry and that's something different.
Come on. I think you're being very harsh.
I am, because it's a film to be harsh about.
No, it's not.
It is.
No, some people like it. But like I said, some people will like it and some people won't. Film's very subjective. Art is very subjective, Greg. I enjoyed it. You didn't.
I enjoy good and interesting paintings where nothing moves. I'm okay about that.
Yeah.
Nothing happens.
Well, it does.
No.
I think it does.
And do you know what? Do you know where the film really lost me? It's a bit of a spoiler here. He goes back in time. I won't say how it happens, but he goes back in time.
Yeah.
And he goes back to the place where his house will be in what I assume is the Old West, the pioneers.
That's right. Yeah.
And his family arrives. Then you hear this woo-woo-woo-woo of Indians attacking. And then suddenly the whole family's dead.
Mm.
And the little girl in her pioneer bonnet is
singing the song. Which
And is then dead. And then suddenly she's an old skeleton with something growing all over her. And I burst out laughing. I'm sorry.
Really?
Oh, both of us. My wife watched. Well, she tried to watch it with me. We both burst out laughing because the film was silly. Any time something interesting happens, you're not allowed to see it. You can't see the car crash. You can't see the Indian attack. It's just this glacial film. Now, I do understand that some people will see that as beautiful, elegiac, maybe meaningful.
Yeah.
And that some people might obviously include you.
Yeah.
But it's not...
I didn't need to see that stuff. I've seen that so many times.
No, but it's like...
It would have been boring to me.
No, it's like you can't be bothered doing... Like, making a film where anything really happens. It's... look, you may like it, and obviously you and I and this mythical podcast listener are going to disagree, and so be it. But I want to warn other people that you really might not like it. And there's a lot of people who don't like it.
Well, I think it's a good thing to tell people that. I mean, I didn't know what to expect, but when it started, I thought, okay, I knew what film I was going to expect from when the first 5 minutes, and I thought, well, enter into this or turn it off, you know. And
do you mean I can actually not watch films that we choose for the podcast after 5 minutes? That is a source of tremendous hope to me. Thank you for telling me that. This might become a very short podcast from now on. So, what did you think, Greg? Didn't watch it. What about this one? Didn't like it.
No, it was the feeling I got from it. I knew what film to expect within the first 5 minutes. Okay, with the long takes and whatnot, I just thought, this is not a spooky film. This is not a specific drama.
I knew it wasn't going to be a spooky film.
A spooky film.
Spooky film. And I also knew what kind of film it was going to be within about 5 minutes.
Yeah.
But there was no sense of, I'm going to enter into this. It was kind of like, I sat there the whole time thinking, bloody Ricardo.
What?
Ricardo, you wanted this film. Yeah, I wanted Ghost. I wanted Stone Tape. I wanted The Haunting. I wanted Blythe Spirit. I wanted 1947's original The Ghost of Mrs.
And
Muir.
And look at this lovely conversation we're having.
This.
Ghost would have been boring.
Why would Ghost be boring?
Well, it's a good movie. I mean, we all know it's a good movie. We all love Ghost.
Oh, not the film, you're in the conversation.
Yeah, the conversation. Whereas this is a good conversation.
I would have a very good conversation with you about Ghost.
Yeah.
Maybe not Blythe Spirit. Maybe not Ghost of Mrs. Muir. Absolutely Stone Tape, which I'm sure you've never heard of.
One of the scariest things
I saw as a child in the 70s. An old black and white BBC show.
Yeah.
The original version of The Haunting, black and white, which is very spooky, is a very interesting film. So, no, we could have had a very good conversation. May not have been as entertaining as me pointing out to you what a heap of tripe
it's
this film
is.
It's
not tripe. Come on, it's not tripe.
So, do you give it a 10?
Huh?
Do you give it a 10?
Of course I don't give it a 10. I'll give it a 7. It's not a classic, right? It's not an 8 to 10, but it's a 7. But I'm not going to say it's tripe. I think it's a very good movie. I enjoyed it.
Well, I gave it a 2. Well, it was going to be a 3 until the little pioneer girl died, and I just laughed and I just thought, nah. So it's a 2. It's right down the bottom of the pack. The only reason it's not a 0 or 1 is it is very beautiful to look at, but I just don't think there's enough there. And the final moment, the bit that you've been waiting for.
Yep.
I won't say what it is,
no.
But you don't get it.
You don't need to get it.
Yeah, I did.
You don't. You don't.
I did.
I didn't. I'm so glad they didn't show it because you don't need to. Because whatever's there, it's enough for him. That's enough for me to know.
I think the writer-director didn't have it in him to work out what it could have said.
No. Apparently Rooney Mara wrote something there which was quite moving to her. And for the situation. So there was something written there, but Rooney Mara won't say what it was.
Well, the great thing is that somebody was moved.
Right. But I was moved by that, actually. I was moved by that. I thought that was a really touching moment. Didn't need it. No, you didn't need to see it.
At that point, I was thinking, that is just typical.
Wow, we're not going to agree at all, are we?
We are not. This is going to be one of the films we'll probably be most divided about.
Yeah.
No. And this will be our landmark to leave for people to always wonder about which of them was right, and how could Ricardo not see that he was wrong?
I'm going to put this on our Facebook page, and I want to get a bit of a gauge of what our listeners are feeling. So come onto our Facebook page, and there'll be a post about a ghost story, and I want to hear from our listeners.
There is one
to see what they thought about it, and I want a discussion because I really liked it. Obviously, Greg didn't, but I'd love to hear people's thoughts about whether they agreed with Richard or whether they agreed
with
Greg.
Well, there's one fundamental problem, deep flaw in that plan. People have to watch the film to have an opinion. Well, I'm surprised that you liked it, Ricardo, because earlier in the week you messaged me to say that you had fallen asleep during a film and that you also had not yet watched A Ghost Story. And I was very careful about what I replied, but I was thinking, just wait till he gets to that. If he fell asleep during this, wait till he gets to that.
I didn't.
Obviously.
I didn't. I quite enjoyed it. So the third film after that one we're going to discuss is Poltergeist 2.
In which things actually happen.
Take it away, Greg.
I saw all three Poltergeist films when they first came out in the 1980s. And I have fond memories of scene number two at the cinema with my sister Liz, being scared side by side by its creepy preacher ghost. And we would sing his spooky hymn to each other when we wanted to recreate that scaredness. In fact, when I contacted her on the weekend, my hardy farmer sister Liz refused to rewatch the film in the lead up to this podcast. The fear is still real. Poltergeist 2, The Other Side, takes place a year after the first film. The Freeling family were left homeless when their house went missing, so they now live with Grandma Jess, Geraldine Fitzgerald. But the ghosts haven't finished with 11-year-old Carol Ann, Heather O'Rourke. The first film attributed the haunting to a graveyard beneath the family home, but now it's discovered that Preacher Kane and his sect were buried deeper down a century or so ago. Kane led families to a cavern to await the apocalypse and refused to let them leave when it didn't eventuate. This story, interestingly, echoes the Jonestown cult massacre from 8 years prior. Kane's spirit, known as the Beast, wants Carol Ann to keep his followers' spirits in line, and so he targets the insecurities of her parents, JoBeth Williams and Craig T. Nelson, to get to Carol Ann. Standing between Kane and the Freeling family are their psychic friend Tangina, Zelda Rubinstein, returning from Poltergeist 1, and Taylor, a native Indian medicine man played by Will Sampson, Chief Bromden from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which we reviewed in Episode 4 earlier this season. Julian Beck is perfectly cast as Kane. His skeletal face and grinning, oversized teeth are what spooked Liz and me all those years ago. He prowls the house in his black western hat and suit, singing hymns while circling for his child prey and unnerving her adult protectors. I hadn't realised till now that this is a direct filmic reference to Robert Mitchum's Harry Powell in The Night of the Hunter that we reviewed in Episode 5 last season. Mm-hmm. Perhaps Grandma Jess is a reference to Lillian Gish. Certainly, I imagine Cain's name is also a direct reference to Cain, the first murderer in the Bible. Sadly, Beck didn't get to see his performance on the big screen, as he died at only 60 before filming completed, becoming part of the urban legend of the Curse of the Poltergeist films. It's a pity because it's a masterful performance. I still find Kane creepy. But the rest of the film is variable. There are some great sequences, such as a haunted tequila worm, followed by Craig T. Nelson's performance as the suburban dad possessed by Kane's spirit. But then it jumps the shark when he vomits up a huge worm creature, which he then defeats through magic smoke. That was scary in the 80s. It's a curiosity piece now. The climax is unbelievably Spielbergian in its resolution. It steps away from the power of a good ghost story to leverage special effects. Back in the 80s, the film lost me with that over-the-topness, and it still does. Ricardo, were you scared by Kane?
Look, let me tell you my poltergeist story. When I was growing up, you know, my uncle and auntie had the video of Poltergeist, and we were just we'd look at the front cover of the TV with her with Carol Ann with
the
hands,
first film?
The first film, and we'd just be like, oh my god, we're gonna watch that movie. And when we watched it, I mean, that was the scary movie. That was the scary movie, and it's still I still love. The original Poltergeist is still an amazing movie. I think it's brilliant. Oh, look, I watched the remake not long ago.
So did I, yeah.
And I didn't mind the remake. I thought they did actually quite a good job.
They did an intelligent update.
They did. Yeah. They did. I got hammered because people don't want there to be a remake of that classic. But
it didn't need to be made.
But they did
a good job.
I think they did a good job. Now, I remember Poltergeist 2 quite well. Now, what I remember from Poltergeist 2 is the preacher.
Yeah.
Right.
That's pretty much all I could remember.
And standing at the house.
Singing the song.
He is bloody creepy. And he scared the crap out of me when I was growing up. That was a creepy, creepy character. And also the worm vomiting up the worm were the two things which really stuck in my memory in that film. Growing up, it was very creepy. Now, I still think he's creepy.
Yeah.
But I'm completely agree with you about the way it ends and the where it goes. To me, it's like Ghostbusters effects. it's all Ghostbusters, and it's not scary at all.
No, I mean,
but there's so many moments in there which aren't scary.
Fantastical rather than scary.
Yeah, that's right. So all the bits with the, you know, oh, the skeleton's in the closet and the big, oh, the arm, it's just not scary anymore. And I found it more funny than scary. But to me, what's so amazing about The Preacher is that it's his performance, the atmosphere, the tension building from that character, the looks. He's fantastic.
You know, it's interesting. The remake of Poltergeist 1, one of the big differences I noticed in that versus the original is in the original film and parts of Poltergeist 2, there's a lot more suggested than shown.
Yes.
And that's spookier.
Yeah, yeah, it is much spookier.
And in some ways, that's the kind of the theory behind, you know, Greek tragedies. The horrible things often happened off stage, kind of like in a ghost story.
Yeah.
But someone would come on stage and tell you about it.
Yeah.
Like the protagonist in a ghost story. But that was the telling of that tale was the moving, powerful part.
Yeah.
Unlike the protagonist in a ghost story. I think I've made that point now. I'll move on.
Please.
So you didn't see a lot of the ghosts. You saw the kind of the horror of what the ghosts did.
Yeah.
And interestingly, in Poltergeist 1 and 2, no one actually dies. People are scared and taken and jostled around. Someone dies in Poltergeist 3.
Yeah. Yes.
One, maybe two characters. Mm. But they don't do a lot of that. But they don't show you a lot of the creepy stuff. But in the remake of Poltergeist 1, when the drone goes into the other realm, and when there are people in there witnessing the other realm, you see everything. You see all these tortured souls scrabbling towards the light or whatever. And the seeing of it, actually, it does two things. It means that you don't imagine it. The power's not in your mind.
That's right.
And the risk is, like the climax in Poltergeist 2, in time to come, that will actually look really dated.
It'll look really dated,
it's actually more effective. And some of those ghost stories I rattled off a few minutes ago, talking about a ghost story, are very effective because they don't show it to you. So
no, they don't.
The haunting Stone Tape.
Your mind is going to create
Fill in
the blanks, yeah. I think to the director, they find that spooky or whatever. But to a lot of people, it wouldn't. I think it's best to be suggestive and to give the audience a picture of what they think is scary. And I think that's scarier than actually showing. So it's one of the bits about the Babadook, which I think is where I think the Babadook lost it in the third act.
We talked about that.
We did. That it's the same sort of thing. When they decided to show it too much, it lost me.
Because that kind of unknowingness itself is fearful.
Oh, very much so.
What did you think of the braces scene?
Okay, the braces, I was about to mention that. You said that not many people died. No one died in this film.
Well, on camera.
On camera.
Quite a few died
off camera.
Camera,
that's right. Look, the braces scene's quite clever, but I find it quite absurd. I mean, the kid would have not probably survived that.
But it's all not real.
It's not, yeah.
See, it's exactly the same as in the first film, the psychic researcher who's scrabbling away
his face.
And then suddenly,
it's gone.
It's back to normal. Same thing with Craig T. Nelson, this film, vomiting up all that black goo and the maggots.
Yes, yes.
It's not real.
It's not real.
This is the power of the beast, is to play up your mind, basically. And so the braces part, it's a bit funny as well.
It is
but
funny,
The wires in his braces go ballistic and he starts becoming almost a wire
mummy.
Well,
he's wrapped in wires.
Up in the ceiling.
Oh, it's clever. It's quite clever.
And what the beast, it makes sense because what the beast is doing is trying to get everyone away from Carol Ann by getting caught up in this other scenario. So I didn't mind that. I think it's a bit funny.
It is funny. Yeah, it is. And it's not scary.
Have you ever had braces?
No.
Nor have I. We're not necessarily the ones to comment on that.
No, that's true.
There might have been some kids, particularly back in 1986,
who
ripped the wires out or something went to bed.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
There were some funny bits in it too, like, you know, we can't have a TV. And the reason they can't have a TV is just what happened in number one.
This is what happened in number one. No, things like that. I mean, they followed it through. They followed the story through really well.
And there was a running gag about the insurance company not paying for the house from the first film because it's just missing, not damaged.
It's just gone.
And later in the film, I was sitting there thinking, well, if the insurance company doesn't believe him about the missing house, wait till they find out what happened to the car. Where a chainsaw just ran amok and tried to cut that car in half.
Car in half. Look, the effects, I think it holds up. I think the film still holds up. But
except the end.
Except for the end.
Yeah.
Yeah, they shouldn't have gone so effects-driven in the end, jumping into the fire and the whole, you know, I just went, oh, this is never-ending story territory and Ghostbusters sort of land of...
But Ghostbusters stands up.
It does more than this. Yeah,
and
right.
Ghostbusters wasn't particularly trying to be scary.
It's around the same time, yeah.
What was Ghostbusters, 84?
84, yeah.
Look, just before we finish up, I just want to come back to Julian Beck because I thought, well, who is this guy who plays this part so well? And in fact, he was a leading light in New York theatre.
Yeah.
Did you read about that?
Yeah, I did.
Was responsible for bringing playwrights like Anton Artaud, Samuel Beckett, Jean Cocteau and Bertolt Brecht and so on.
Yes.
Into the local theatre scene.
Yeah, he was very well known in that scene. And I didn't know that. Oh, look, he looks sick in this film. He died a year later. I think he must have been sick in this movie.
Oh, he'd been diagnosed 3 years prior, or 2 years prior to filming with stomach cancer.
Yes, that's right.
So I don't know if the production knew about it, but he must have known that things weren't good. And he does. But that kind of creates his character. He looks like death.
He does.
Will Sampson, the medicine man, he died unexpectedly a year or two after the film. I think he was having heart surgery. Heather O'Rourke died in post-production of the little girl, Poltergeist 3.
Yes.
So if you see Poltergeist 3, she looks quite puffy. She was on cortisone treatment, I think, at the time.
And well, what did she die of?
A bowel blockage.
Right.
The older sister in the first film, she died. She was strangled by her boyfriend and died later on life support. She was the daughter of a very famous writer for, I think, Vanity Fair, Dominic Dunn.
Really?
Yep. It was a big case afterwards. So I'm not sure if Dominique Dunn, who played the older sister, I'm not sure if she died before or after the first film was released, but she certainly died in that year, 82. And in the second film, they were going to film a sequence where she was at college and it got cut from the film or wasn't filmed or something. But there's no mention of her. Like,
no, there's not.
Why? Like, there's not even like a throwaway line about
where she's at.
Oh, she's so and so just rang from college.
Yeah, that's right. She's
just kind of erased.
Yeah.
And I wonder what happened, you know, upon the release of Poltergeist 1, whether that was a big issue. But certainly when it came to Poltergeist 3, because Heather O'Rourke had died while they were doing post production, they actually stopped Tom Skerritt and Nancy Allen, who played her aunt and uncle.
Yeah.
From doing interviews because they didn't want focus on the fact she died. It was just such a horrible thing for everyone.
Yeah.
But then this myth has started to develop that, you know, the two sisters, Anne Will Sampson and Julian Beck,
yes,
had died unexpectedly soon after their particular film had been made. So you get this urban legend developing, which is a pity because Dominique Dunn, she's really good in her part as a sister.
Yeah, she is.
Heather O'Rourke, I think she might have always been a child actor, but she could actually mean quite interesting in later career. She's good in the part.
She's very good in the part.
She's believable and sometimes a bit creepy as well.
Yeah, yeah.
And as we've said, Julian Beck is fantastic. And he and Will Sampson went much too young. So that's kind of
a
sad legacy that kind of, you know, lingers around the films.
It does. I mean, look.
There was also a serious accident when they filmed Poltergeist 3. Do you remember the scene in the car park with the cars all covered in snow?
No.
Where the cars are trying to run over the aunt and uncle. Apparently, some of that polystyrene or foam, whatever it was, that created the snow effect caught fire. And there were, I think, a couple of stuntmen and someone else who were quite seriously hurt at the time.
Like, wow.
It's got this kind of reputation hanging over it. But, you know, that's all by the by.
In terms of that, I'll say the makeup is very good in these. Like, the creature makeup and the skeletons and everything like that are very well done.
For their time, yeah.
For their time. But the actual visual effects, for the time, great. I mean, you find that nowadays. I mean, you watch films from the 90s now, which were great effects movies now, are looking a bit dated.
Yeah, but problem with Poltergeist 2 was it just didn't need to go there.
It didn't need to go there. It did not.
But it does feel very, very Spielbergian.
Yeah, very. Well, yeah. He's probably.
Do you know the ongoing controversy from the first film about who directed it?
Well, I know that Spielberg was producing it. I don't think Spielberg directed it in the
end. A lot of to and froing about who really was the creative eye behind the direction, whether it was Spielberg or Toby Hooper. Different actors have said that they were directed by Spielberg or Hooper about how if Spielberg didn't like something, he overrode Hooper and so on. So I think the consensus now is that Hooper was the director, but it's one of those things where it reminded me of Tim Burton's Nightmare Before Christmas. Oh, remember that controversy about there was he directing it? It was the same kind of setup.
Henry Selick,
Burton was doing the second Batman film and so couldn't spare the time because the studio pressure was on him to do that. And ditto for Spielberg, he was contractually obliged to focus on E.T. at the time. And so you got the situation where there's a very powerful creative who have defined a film, and it's known as Tim Burton's Nightmare Before Christmas, and this is known as a Spielbergian film or a Spielbergian trilogy. But you feel a bit sorry for the directors of those films who kind of, yeah, their legacy's kind of marginalised.
Well, Tobe Hooper did the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre, always have that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so even though this does have Spielberg flair to it, it's still a Tobe Hooper film. To me, the director is the director. I mean, look, no one would call Kubrick the real director of Spartacus. I mean, there were so many directors on that, but he's the final director.
I'm the director. No, I'm the director. did you see the tribute to Tobe Hooper on the remake of Number One?
No.
Right at the end of the film, there's a little bumper sticker on the car, and the local college is called Hooper College.
Oh, that's lovely.
Which is nice.
Yeah, that's really
nice.
Yeah, that is nice. So what are you going to give this, Greg?
I'm giving this a 6. It's not as scary as I remember, but for me, it gets up there purely because of the performance of Julian Becker's Kane.
I'm going to get snap, except for the ghost story.
Isn't it nice how we always agree on films? Yeah.
I was giving this a 6 as well. The fact that it doesn't really scare me that much anymore was a bit disappointing. But Beck still scares me. That was still a creepy character. So I thought, well, I'll up it to a 6. I was going to be a 5 at one point, but I just went,
I think he lifts it.
He does lift it, yes.
Listen, before we leave this film alone, or rather this trilogy alone,
yes,
I just want to give a bit of publicity to the Poltergeist 3 game, because there's, in the script of Poltergeist 3, an awful lot of the script is characters yelling out the names of other characters, like, Carol Ann, Carol Ann, and so on. And apparently a fun activity, we're going to have to try and work out if we can do this one day. A fun activity is to go and watch Poltergeist 3, and whenever someone yells out another character's name in, fear or horror or, I want to rescue you kind of stuff, the audience yells the name back. It's a bit like you hear with Rocky Horror Picture Show, how some people, they'll do performances where people throw toast and yell lines back and so on.
Yes.
It sounds like fun, and if there's any cinema, particularly in Melbourne, where we are, who wants to run this, then maybe we should host it. That would be a fun thing to do.
A fun night, yeah. So that concludes our ghostly episode 8 of season 4 of the Filmmaker Film Watcher podcast.
Where probably the spookiest thing was how much we didn't agree on the middle film.
Quite honestly, it didn't surprise me that much, but Greg, I thought you might not like that one.
And yet you chose it.
Yes, of course. So for our next episode, we're going to go back to some escapism, Greg.
We are, and this is because we're going back into lockdown here in Melbourne. So like we did earlier in the season when we said we want something to amuse us, make us laugh, this time we're going to visit one of the smallest genres that probably exists in the whole history of filmdom, which is Disney films based on Disney rides.
So it's going to be our Ticket to Ride episode.
That's right. Very Beatlish. And our first film will be
2003's The Haunted Mansion with Eddie Murphy.
Yes, and then we're going to look at quite a recent film, 2021's Jungle Cruise with Emily Blunt and The Rock.
And then we're going to be looking at 2015's Tomorrowland, which stars George Clooney, Hugh Laurie, and it's a Brad Bird film.
Yes, and I say it's a small genre of films or subgenre of films, but in fact we had to take films off that shortlist, didn't we? Like Pirates of the Caribbean.
Yeah, we did.
The Tower of Terror, I think it was, which was their first attempt. So it'll be interesting to sample this little subgenre that we've discovered.
Oh, I think it's a welcome little piece of escapism for us and our audience.
What we need right now.
Thank you so much for listening to our ghostly episode. Please again go to our Facebook page and I'll have a Facebook post about a ghost story. Please give us your thoughts underneath whether you agreed or disagreed with myself and Greg.
And if you don't agree with me, I'm going to just trounce off in a huff.
Thank you so much for listening, everyone. Take care. Stay safe out there.
See you next time on This Side or The Other Side.